confronting fear. It's the destiny of a Jedi. Your destiny.
Welcome to a very special edition of Film Fight Club.
A very special of Film Fight Club.
A very Star Wars and holiday, a very Star Wars holiday special.
That's good morning, Sydney.
Yes, this if this is just Film Star Wars, Fight Club.
Star Wars, the original, is a Vietnam War analogy, so that was a very well-placed reference, some might say. Combined with World War II, combined with a bunch of other things.
Yeah, this was not.
This
one was not, no.
Does not. care about the franchise as much. And thank you, Chris, for acknowledging that I made a very clever reference to it.
This is Glenn Falcon, Cyber Falcon Screen, Chris, Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans, and freelance writing critic Virat Nehru. We have literally just walked off the midnight screening of Star Wars with the crowd you kind of want to see Star Wars with, and we're going to be giving you...
The nerds.
It was scary. I've never seen that kind of fandom in real life before, and I was actually terrified.
I was very impressed with some of
them. It was just a bunch of...
I'd never seen like people come out and dress for a movie screening. It's just a movie in the end.
Force Awakens, they came out. Jedi so much.
You've got to do a midnight screening once just to see it.
Okay, yeah. Well, I did it. And survived.
And we've done it. So we're giving you our unfiltered, spoiler-free discussions about The Rise of Skywalker.
Later on, we'll also be covering
Cats.
I know everyone's been waiting for that one.
Now, we haven't looked at the internet. We don't know what anyone said.
We don't know what the general reaction is. And we famously often get out of step with what the masses think. Because, you know, I came out thinking everyone would love The Last Jedi. How wrong was I?
Yeah, so...
Because we're edgy and alternative.
Yeah. We're not going to talk about the plot of the film beyond the first 5 minutes, i.e. the first scene and the crawl.
Yeah, we'll spoil that much, but there's stuff relating to plot materials that have already been revealed in the marketing. But in case you've been avoiding that, we think that the setup of a movie is fair game.
Yeah, well, our general rule is nothing happens in the first 10 or 15 minutes as a spoiler. We're limiting it here to the first 5 minutes. So the basic setup of this film... it takes place a little bit after The Last Jedi. We are told that there's been a broadcast from the Emperor Palpatine, which has gone out across the galaxy. Everyone is searching for them. And we see in the opening scene that Palpatine somehow
He's back.
He's back. And he has a pretty impressive collection of toys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which he may use to wreak havoc on, well, everyone. The galaxy, he's just been slowly accumulating this over, God, since what, Return of the Jedi?
Yeah, Snoke was his creation, we're told. He was actually behind it all. Yeah, he says, I created Snoke, and he's been in the shadows. Everything that's been happening all along was actually the Emperor. Okay, when I heard about this in the trailers, my first reaction was, this is stupid. But... I was hoping that there would be a good explanation for it. They cop out on that hard.
It isn't. There's no explanation how
they literally say
doing this.
Yeah, they literally say the Emperor is somehow back. That's the explanation. That somehow the Emperor is back. How did they think this was acceptable? It's such a stretch to bring back the guy who died so spectacularly and created like a force explosion at the core of a space station that all exploded. He fell down a large shaft, created an explosion, and then blew up again. But he's back.
It feels like such, as a lot of this film is, such an attempt at fan service and placating the people who were upset by The Last Jedi. I had mixed views on it. I've since come around to being more of a fan of it. But this is the whole film, in many respects, is very much designed to be generally acceptable to both sides of the Star Wars divide that was, I think, created or just brought about by The Last Jedi coming about.
The problem of corporate filmmaking. You've got to please everyone and never take an interesting stance. Disney's Star Wars, you know, Lucas's movies were really bad, but at least
Phantom Menace had redeeming quality.
Doubled down. He went after what he wanted and took it at Star Wars in some weird directions.
And building was great. There's not a lot of world building here.
Well, yeah, I'm going to get back to the Palpatine thing in just a moment, but I'm not going to say that Lucas's prequels were good, but something that they had going for them is if you turn the music off, he really had some great imagination going on between him and his artists in sketching out, taking Star Wars in different directions. Like, what J.J. Abrams keeps doing is, like, another Tatooine. Or, like, familiar, another Endor. Familiar Star Wars environs. Yeah, whereas,
this was a loud film. I think that's the other thing you're right.
On George Lucas's series. It's very enlightening.
So, what were you saying?
The Richard Brody piece on George Lucas's Star Wars. It's very enlightening.
I'll give it a read. But, yeah, he went with some really interesting designs for planets, and he was clearly trying to expand the universe and imagine new, cool sci-fi ideas.
There are moments in the very beginning of the film where we get a glimpse of what at that sort of scale, but it doesn't really eventuate throughout the movie.
What were you saying about the...
So, like, part of the problem with this film is everything is almost foreshadowed with really loud music. And I think what J.J. Abrams does, maybe that's his signature style, is, like, everything needs to be turned up to 11.
The intensity of, like...
Yeah, rah, rah, rah. And that really annoyed me because I was trying to really hard to sleep. So, you know, I wanted to...
The midnight screening with all that's been going on for Virat turned out to be too much for him. So full disclosure, he slept for a good chunk of the film, but we spoke to him afterwards and I think he has the general impression.
Yeah, because anyone who's seen The Force Awakens can get a pretty good idea of... And all the J.J. Abrams can get an idea of his style of filmmaking. It follows
And also, the plot's pretty simple.
Yeah, the mystery box style. We saw in The Force Awakens how there was a map, which only one person had to need the piece from it. And there is
it's a story running through this,
which if you unpack it even a little, doesn't make much sense
at
all.
It's about
just very loosely tying the film together.
We've got to grab this MacGuffin that takes us to this planet for this action scene, where there'll be another MacGuffin that takes us to this place, and we've got to rescue this guy and whatever.
It's a treasure hunt, but in a film that is trying to be sincere and try to bring you along on this journey, which in a kid's movie where you don't really have to think about that stuff, it works. But Star Wars has such a lore and inbuilt fandom knowledge that you need that integrity in the storytelling, which is really absent here.
The truth is, Star Wars, at its best, is a really good kids' movie. George Lucas has always maintained that Star Wars should be accessible to kids and overall is a kids' movie. I think he's right. This, especially with this one, to me, this is not more complicated than like Harry Potter or something.
The comparisons with Harry Potter are curious. We can get to those.
Midway through the movie, I was saying to someone else who was watching it, like, is it just me or is this just like Harry Potter more than Star Wars?
And
she said, yep.
It had the what made the elements of The Force Awakens and more of The Last Jedi interesting is that it toyed with the idea of it isn't simply black and white, light and dark. And while the Kylo Ren Rey arc, which we also see throughout this film, was my favorite part of it, my favorite part of this whole trilogy, separate to that, it had very black and white ideas of the dark side of the Force, light side of the Force. And
absolutely.
That dichotomy was just, you saw it in the original series, it was fine, but we want more nuance in storytelling today. And for the most part of the film, accepting the two main players' arc was not there.
We, as in us three in this room talking to you now, want more nuance in storytelling today, but do the general public? Avengers Endgame is smashed all records, and it had the dumbest big bad villain.
Of course the general public want nuance. I mean, you said earlier tonight, Marriage Story.
You're right.
We're also with Adam Driver, people are seeking out better storytelling.
You're right.
They do want it.
But the question is, you know, especially with franchises like this, which have such fandom behind them, I think it's difficult to balance expectations around trying to do something different versus actually trying to please the fans. This film really struggled with that.
People rebelled in a big way against The Last Jedi.
Which was the most interesting film out of the
three
of them.
To me,
absolutely. It's the best film by far
by
out of all
a good margin. Okay, going back to what you were saying about like good and evil just then, I was thinking as I watched this that like I want to see at least something of a if you're going to present these big, bad, evil forces, I want to see just something of a meditation on those themes. Like, you know, I'm not saying, you know, that they need to be super dark shades of gray complicated or something, but I'd like to see some kind more of a hint at like what drives them beyond just like that they're evil and they want to do evil things and rule the galaxy to do evil. Like, do they want to rule the galaxy because of ego? Like Kylo Ren in Force Awakens at least gave sort of like the hint at that like this is all like an ego trip. Just something to kind of ground the idea of evil, because it's rolling back on the great thing that J.J. Abrams did in Force Awakens, which is to try to make the dark side of the Force more relatable, you know? Like,
yeah, there's a key thing here. Palpatine is like the dark elf. We have to be clear. I'm talking about Thor 2, that terrible one. With the first two films, Kylo Ren was the main villain. And yes, he has a key role in this.
Such an interesting villain.
But that role is taken up to a large extent by the presence of Palpatine, who is such an all-encompassing figure.
Right.
So you have simply good evil versus, as opposed to someone struggling with good and someone, oh, wait a minute, Kylo Ren, what side, well, we saw in The Last Jedi,
what side is he
actually on?
Yeah, okay.
Which you get a bit of here, but it's overtaken by, you know, classic Voldemort.
Yeah, two things about Palpatine. One, I think the reason, it's just so frustrating, I think the reason why he's in here is if you looked at The Last Jedi, it's 3 a.m., tired. If you look at The Force Awakens, Snoke was being set up as the big bad by J.J. Abrams, and he was just clearly a fanservice-y echo of the Emperor. There's this, you know, guy behind it all who's introduced as a shadowy hologram, and he's going to become more important later. Rian Johnson tried to move this series towards something new and just wrote that off. I think he correctly identified that Snoke was not interesting. It was too similar to what we'd seen before. And that the interesting thing that JJ had set up was the Rey and Kylo dynamic. I think he tried to clear the table and say, let's just remove extraneous side plots so that the series can be focused in on that. And it feels like J.J. Abrams has spat the dummy because his plan of having the big Emperor Snoke at the end has been foiled. So let's just bring back the original Emperor, and I don't even have a reason why. I don't have an explanation. I just want that to be in the movie, and you're going to take it because this is what I want.
Okay, the Rey-Kyle dynamic's great. We'll get more to that later.
But on the Emperor...
On the Emperor, yes. When we talked about The Last Jedi a couple of years back, my major criticism then, it's less of a criticism now because it did take the series interesting ways, is how Johnson consigned so many arcs in the original film to dramatic irrelevance. J.J. Abrams doubles down on that, but more problematic is that it's a reversion to what we've seen before. We feel like we're going backwards.
Yeah.
This is a big problem. The whole film, it feels like he just wants to ignore aspects of The Last Jedi and suddenly, oh, I had this idea. I have to account for what was in The Last Jedi, but now I want to tell my story. And it's not entirely your story anymore.
Case in point, Palpatine. What you were saying before about how The Last Jedi, it brought out this idea of where Luke Skywalker says, you know, I've been thinking, it's not just about good and evil, it's about balance, and that those ideas are maybe too simple and something we should try to move beyond. It's almost like a meta fourth wall breaking moment of him trying to make Star Wars more morally and philosophically interesting. Without turning his back on the kind of like elemental good and evil thing, but it's part of the process of deepening it. I think I actually think a lot of people say that Last Jedi was just turning its back on Force Awakens, but I think in a way it was deepening the best things about Force Awakens. Getting back to the Emperor, right? As you say, that we had an interesting villain of Kylo Ren in the first two films, because Kylo Ren is someone who you would actually potentially turn for, right? Like because Adam Driver has shirtless scenes and gets to have sexual tension and stuff, and also gets to show more shades of gray and some good sides of his personality shining through. It makes believable the idea that Rey might turn to the dark side. You know, it's the central, it's like the Luke Skywalker join me thing from the original series, but it's way more believable now than it's ever been before. That like the previous two trilogies did a poor job of you know, conveying that how that turn would actually work. So now in the last movie, we just have this really, really evil big bad because he's evil, Lord Voldemort, dark wizard, robed Satan guy with pointy fingers. And it's like, there's no dramatic tension because he's not sexy like Kylo Ren. I never believe that this guy could ever convince Rey to turn to the dark side.
No. I mean, it's more that Driver's the best thing about this film and every film he's in. Mm. He's charismatic. And I can see him running the Knights of Ren. I can see someone saying, oh, wait a minute, being pulled over. The scene in the throne room, there's a fair argument. He makes what I think is a fair argument, but at least a compelling argument. Someone in that circumstance would be compelled to listen to it. On the matter of the thematic switch within the series, I agree that Last Jedi deepened elements of The Force Awakens, and one thing that Last Jedi doubled down on, which was more hinted at The Force Awakens, is the idea that anyone is special. It's not about lineage, the idea that there are Force-sensitive people, there are people out there who can engage with the Force and who can, regardless of where they quote-unquote come from, can make a difference. And certainly the original trilogy, episodes 4, 5, and 6, dealt with this to a great extent. This film moves away from this theme. It's not necessarily reversion. It just looks to other thematic arcs, and that was when the film had the redeeming parts of Canto Bight with the young children and the character played by Lupita Nyong'o.
Yeah.
And this doesn't pursue that. It just leaves it by the wayside.
Focusing so strongly on lineage makes this universe feel really small. It takes away from some of the magic and the relatability that could possibly be in Star Wars if people had the room to dream bigger. And the issue at the end of the day, like the biggest problem with this movie for me, is that it really, really good versus really, really evil is just not that interesting. Like there's no, they beyond the action has to be really well executed for that something as simple as that to register.
And the action isn't great.
No.
The action is so crowded in the frame.
What did you think of the action?
No, actually, I think in terms of the set pieces and visual design, I think this actually does offer something really fresh and interesting.
I agree. I think that it is well designed.
But I think that's because of the comparative lack of creativity in setting up those pieces, that when the pieces do come, you're like, oh, there's something interesting happening.
Here's the bit he focused on.
You know, so it's interesting because usually our critique is like the action is boring in a lot of these films. But here the action itself and the scenes and how they're executed are very well staged, very well directed. And actually, there's a lot going on in terms of the psychology within those action sequences, which is more than the actual setup. I think the setup is really bad, but when the action sequences come, they're more interesting than the setup.
I think the more intimate ones had showed that kind of psychology and like backdrop and like...
I woke up at the right moment in the action sequences. Yeah, there must have been bad ones before.
There were, definitely. Early on, there's an action scene where I just thought this is just noisy. Like it's just the action's shot too close, too quick editing. And it just sort of didn't register that well. And it, like comparable to some action in Return of the Jedi, which I think J.J. Abrams is looking to for a template, except that film in its slower pacing and, you know, wider shots was just more fun to watch.
I didn't like the action in this film with the exception of the very first action sequence, which is evolved as Chase extensively utilizing
the
hyperdrive.
That's the
where there is quite a, you see a lot of different scenarios and sequences, and that's quite entertaining. I think this film, more than any of the other Star Wars films, has a less of a focus on practical effects in the action sequences. Certainly, J.J. Abrams is someone who's well known for using special VFX, so it's not predictable. There is one sequence involving sand, which I quite enjoyed. Otherwise, the sequences were weren't especially creative compared to anything else we've seen in the Star Wars universe, and were repetitive compared to what we've seen in action sequences over now several films, up to and including returning to areas that we're familiar with and have seen and aren't new or exciting.
Were there any things in particular that we liked?
I'll extend it to Daisy Ridley. I liked her in this film more.
Me too.
The dynamic with her, between her and Kylo.
She's definitely improved with each film, yeah. So I guess she's shown that promise.
Yeah, her performance here was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, Star Wars involves a lot of intense emoting, and here she did it the most convincingly.
Yeah, this is the best performance to date.
Yeah.
I liked the main three, John Boyega and Oscar Isaac. They were good.
They just don't have much to do. The problem with this movie, there's a lot of problems with this movie, is that there's way too much going on. The Last Jedi is a film that the main criticism of it probably, is that too much is going on and the subplot threads take up too much time of the film and aren't well developed enough, and the main plot thread, which is the most interesting, could be more developed. I agree. The Last Jedi was 150 minutes long. This one's 140 minutes long. This has so much more going on than The Last Jedi, and it's mostly really underdeveloped. And when you consider that most of the plot is a fetch quest.
Yeah, including the bit where this is in the trailer, we meet Lando returns, Billy Dee Williams, and it's just, you're suddenly here. This is great. Good to see
Again,
you, Lando.
This universe just feels small with the ways that they try to tie it all into a select few groups and people and families that have been established already, and that's a pretty bad idea if Disney want this to be a series that just generates new installments and sustains itself into the future. There's too much going on.
Yeah, there's a new... the Peter Cushing character, Moff Tarkin.
Richard E. Grant.
Yeah, there's a new Moff Tarkin too.
There's a new bunch of things because I guess they want to sell more toys. Yeah.
And Richard E. Grant's good, but suddenly, we just want to stand in for Moff Tarkin, so he's there. Another thing that really frustrated me about this, it frustrated me about The Last Jedi too. They've never known what to do with General Hux, Domhnall Gleeson's character. He was the best in the first film.
I thought he was used well
when
here,
he was
not
most
enough of him.
Terrifying. In the second one, he was consigned to being thrown about rooms as a piece of comedy. Here, again, it's like Matt Damon in the Ocean's trilogy. He's a different character in each film. They're frustrated. They didn't know what to do with him. I didn't like him in this movie. We can't really talk about it too much without spoilers.
We'll talk about it next year when we do a spoiler on the podcast.
But it's to simply say it didn't make sense to me. It didn't pan out.
We were talking about action before, and I've been thinking since watching this half an hour ago, you know, I've been thinking long and hard. big CG action scenes... almost always when I check out, it's really hard to do them well. The one redeeming feature of James Cameron's Avatar is that the big CG action scene with a bunch of spaceships flying around like Star Wars, like what this film tries to do and Star Wars films traditionally have, and was really good. There was a big Star Wars-esque action scene at the end of that movie where we're cross-cutting between CG spaceships shooting each other, people running around on ships, dropping bombs and stuff. And there's a very similar scene at the end of this. And I was just thinking how... It actually, people underestimate what it takes to really make those scenes interesting. It's not enough to just wow us with a big CGI budget and a bunch of things going on screen anymore. You need to have the skills of an action director on a really high level. It's like a complex action scene requires complex staging, complex spatial geography, and it needs to be made fluid and exciting. And I like most films that go down this path these days, I don't think this pulls it off. I don't think J.J. Abrams is a good enough director of action to make this kind of thing work.
No, I didn't like the final action sequence for the reasons that every film, and a lot of the Marvel films, and certainly The Force Awakens with Starkiller Base, feels it has to up the ante in terms of either the weaponry or what is at stake. Mm. Also, the presence of what we've seen in every film, the gimmick that we, the sky beam type intensity, it's just unnecessary. Whereas in The Last Jedi, it was very clear what the stakes were. There was a set number of the resistance who could die if the retreat was not successful. Yep. Go to the classic Dark Knight example. It wasn't about the whole city or world being destroyed. It was two ships full of people.
That's
which
right.
is a lot of people, but the stakes are confined, we know. But this felt just had to up the ante again. And we don't need that, especially when we have characters we are familiar with
and care
dear
about.
To.
Yeah, the intimate stuff, as Virat said, is like where more of the actual psychology is coming into play. And it's relatable on a human level. As a tangent, beyond Avatar, is there any film that has pulled off this kind of large-scale CGI battle at all? Well, it's always so boring to me.
I didn't mind the end of Infinity War.
Yeah, okay, I'll grant that. Actually, I think it did it really well. By contrast, the one in Endgame was terrible.
And I would say for those fans of Star Trek Discovery, the end of Season 2, the final two episodes, handles it very well.
Haven't seen that, so I can't comment. Okay, it's so common in our action movies these days, but it's just so usually boring. You know, it's a shame. Anyway.
The small-scale action sequences I enjoyed more.
I think people just underestimate how hard it is to do that, and they just go with it because it's the trend. I wish you'd thought this through. Maybe it's just really hard to depict a battle on that scale, and people need to maybe approach it in a more abstract way, focusing on little moments that matter instead of just vomiting, exploding things onto the screen.
I mean, there was one other thing that sort of made it really difficult for me to sit through or whatever, you know, put me asleep essentially or made it a slog, was even though, like you said, J.J. Abrams has really confined his world to a few families and few people,
yeah.
But even those relationships felt really underdeveloped.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at this point, we're in the end game now, or whatever,
right.
of this trilogy.
Yeah, we are. This is the third of the three major sagas we've included this year. The Marvel series, in a sense, Star Wars and Game of Thrones. We've seen the big three constructions of our time include in 2019.
Logically, like, you know, you would think that the emotional kind of connections between these main relationship that you're exploring would be at its strongest.
Yes, it should
be very developed
by now.
But actually, at this point, you know, if they feel like threadbare, thin kind of threads.
They do.
And not even that. It just feels illogical. Some of the things that characters are saying and kind of feeling, are just like, why? Like, this is so late in the game. Why are you introducing and introducing new elements which don't go anywhere, which is even worse.
Especially when you leave characters by the wayside who are relevant to the previous series. One of the new great new characters, probably the best new character introduced in The Last Jedi, was Rose Tico. And I know she got a huge backlash.
Spoilers.
She's a standard. I don't think it's a spoiler.
No, it's not.
She's a standard. Her role could have been filled by any extra in this. It's pathetic that she was not given an arc in this.
It's really
closely
like,
akin to The Last Jedi. And I know there were. Okay, to the extent that this is J.J. Abrams saying, I don't want anything to do with what happened in The Last Jedi, that's terrible. But to whatever extent, it is a way to placate those who are highly critical of her presence, and that's just awful. No, her character didn't deserve this.
It could be something much more simple and much more petty than that, which is J.J. Abrams is going, I didn't create...
An ego trip?
Yeah, I didn't create this character.
Yeah, it's Rian Johnson's thing, so I'm not going to touch anything he did. I'm just going to feel like where I left off was Force Awakens and that should never happen kind of thing.
She could have been a stooge. She could have been a nameless character in this.
That's right, yeah. I was saying that she has about as much of a role, really. She appears in more scenes, but about as much of a role as this recurring character in this trilogy who's like she's an older lady with a really interesting face who always looks really sad that the Rebels are losing and reports stuff.
Those who hounded the actress who played Rose on social media will probably be
thrilled with this. At the end of it, okay, I'm not spoiling the movie, but it's the end of this big saga, and it just, at the end of the day, comes down to the most simple idea of good versus evil. And it's been done at the end of the Return of the Jedi, you know, that like that the saga comes to an end and it's just good versus evil and it's simple, right? You can still do a great good versus evil story, but leave some kind of theme or some kind of moral resonating. It doesn't, this beyond just resolving the story, this doesn't really, at the end of the day, feel like it was about anything. There's not really any sort of grand theme for you to think about in the way that it resolves. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. We were pursuing, again, as referred to earlier, the idea of everyone is special, which is a great theme for The Last Jedi. This is very much, this kind of feels like, actually, I would make the comparison. This kind of feels, yes, good, evil, black, white.
Yeah.
Here's the side you want to be on. Here's the side you don't want to be on. None of the nuance which is implied from The Last Jedi and The Force Awakens of Kylo's arc. None of the nuance which we saw with Darth Vader in Return of the Jedi. It's gone.
Yeah.
I think Kylo gets the biggest disservice because he's been set up as a very much more interesting character than he is in this film. Which is also interesting because, you know... And the prospect of Adam Driver actually, you know, tapping into something which we didn't think was there.
He's still working on levels that no one else in this film is working on.
It's just like his visual emotiveness is fantastic in this movie. Especially, and then what happens with his arc is very disappointing.
I agree. It's just such a shame.
I'll disagree. We can't talk about this without spoilers. I liked the arc, but...
I actually agree with you. I liked his arc too. I just feel like it still feels disappointing in the way that it's resolved. And I guess how simple and how little... There still is a lot of it in the movie, I guess, compared to everything else, because nothing has much emphasis because this movie is so fast-paced. But I still wish there was more of it in this movie. I still wish there was more illustrating his psychology and his thought processes. That said, what is there is sometimes really good. There's a lot of fan service in this movie, but the way that this movie, when it tries to not just say, hey, remember this cool thing, but tie in those things from the past into the new context and the new characters and new themes, it does it really well. There's some nice moments like that. One in particular that
I agree.
I thought was actually...
I think we're thinking of the same thing. The one moment of fan service is the best scene of the film, which I've
heard. It's actually like quite well executed and quite moving. And there are other points in the movie that I felt were kind of moving.
Not sure what you're referring to.
Well, I won't spoil this.
We're telepathically talking right
That's
now.
That's right. We're like part of Kylo and Rey.
Yeah, we're linked. Yeah.
That said,
the
Last Jedi and Force Awakens, especially Last Jedi, brought up this thing of like them kind of telepathically communicating and crossing the divides in space and time.
Yeah.
This does that too. In some actually really cool ways.
And it grants us new understandings of the Force. Not overloaded, entirely new, like we saw with Leia in The Last Jedi. Right, yeah. It just envelops a little further what we've come to know, and it's great. It's one of my, one of the only, and one of my, probably my favorite innovation of this whole
and
film.
And those moments seem to be like quite well directed. Interesting camera movement.
And funny.
Interesting camera, wit, funny, yes, and witty kind of use of the camera to show like the crossing between space. I thought like, don't get me wrong.
It wasn't just cross cut, reverse, non-reverse.
Don't get me wrong. There are some good things about this film. There are some nice moments showing how Rey cares for people around her and the other creatures in the universe. There are some good things in this film, but it's rare that there are these grace notes that kind of elevate it. You can clearly see that J.J. Abrams has some talent. There is a grandeur to this film that sometimes approaches a kind of beauty.
There's an epic, I mean, in the traditional sense, that you see with some of the Kylo Rey specific moments.
Yeah.
But otherwise, not else. Like Endgame, it just kind of strives for this, oh, it's cataclysmic, therefore you must care about it. And I don't care about that as much as the interpersonal relationships, which we've seen it develop over three and in some cases many more films.
It was building to a point of grandeur and like true epic scale, I think, where if they stuck the landing, I would have forgiven a lot more about this film. But then it just falls into convention in the worst way in the last final stretch. And, you know, this movie concludes with a big moment of fan service, and I felt nothing.
We need to talk about, so as has been widely discussed and publicized, Carrie Fisher is in this. It is her final film. A lot, by necessity of her passing, a lot of her scenes were digitally rendered. I think it was handled in very well and very respectfully. I quite like that.
I think so too. They were very smart with how they reused their existing footage of Leia.
Very much so. And there was a flashback sequence involving some of the mainstays of the Star Wars saga, which wasn't so well handled. I think it was actually unnecessary. Mm. It was distracting because it wasn't nearly as well rendered as many of the other sequences. There were also two, we'll speak about in the broader sense, cameos. One was handled with a sense of grandeur and reverence. I really appreciated their appearance.
Me too.
The other one, I think they're trying to do something akin to what we've seen with characters returning earlier in the saga. However, this particular performer, honestly, while they were going for a sense of, yes, again, we say it, grandeur, I don't think this performer really came across as caring that much, giving much of a damn, and therefore that sequence didn't land as well as I think J.J. Abrams hoped it would.
I agree.
It just seemed kind of like I'm here. I'm going to be a little irreverent about this.
On the subject of these cameos, and also, you know, me sort of giving props before and saying that sometimes this film is moving, there's nothing as moving in this film as the Yoda coming back in The Last Jedi and talking about the burden of being a teacher and how failure is the best teacher of all. Like that, just a simple, beautiful moment that spoke to the philosophy that Rian Johnson was trying to concentrate on in the series. Virat, right before we recorded, made the comment that this is just so philosophically boring in comparison. It's philosophically empty. It's void. In comparison.
And that's, I think, part of the frustration of watching this film is the possibility of where this could have gone and where it ends up going.
Yeah.
You know, and there is such a disconnect into, like, you know, what The Last Jedi has set up.
Yeah.
And it left you in a very tantalizing place of like, oh, so Star Wars could actually go in so many new directions. And it doesn't really end up doing that, which is the frustration which I have, I guess, not but just with this film. You're left with this sense of what could have been throughout the whole saga. You know, this kind of...
Yeah. And, you know, kind of in closing, do you guys see much of a future for Star Wars after this?
Not for the saga as such. I think if they're going to have to... If we're going to go in the direction of new Star Wars films, people aren't going to want an episode 10. They're going to want to see Knights of the Old Republic. They're going to want to see classic Star Wars going back to the early days of the Jedi, exploring this world. Completely different material. Even The Mandalorian is set in the context of the broader saga, as is Rogue One, as is Solo. We're going to have to move wholly away from this, I think, if we're going to get fans renewed or consistently engaged.
I feel like the damage might already be done from how closely this movie stuck to convention. I feel like it's going to be very hard to get people interested in the series when it's ended on, I think, what most people will find to be an anticlimax. And as you say, like how many, it's spent a lot of films covering this original trilogy and original trilogy homaging timeline and ground, how many chances are people going to get? Even if they break out now and do something original and interesting, will the audience show up? It might need to build momentum over time.
They need a break between you can't have the solo Last Jedi type 6 months between movies. They're going to need some time. Absolutely.
We'll see, you know.
Just a couple of things to note about this film.
But they've got Kevin Feige producing one.
Yes.
We'll see. We'll
see. Just a couple of small notes on some of the performers. Kerry Russell is in this. She's very good. People remember her earliest collaboration with J.J. Abrams in Felicity. Great show from the early 2000s. There's also a number of voice cameos if you stay through the credits, one of which I'm not sure what role they played was Freddie Prinze Jr. So he's in this. He's credited.
He loves Star Wars. I guess it's just a tip of the hat for him.
And yeah, so that is The Rise of Skywalker. It is in cinemas now everywhere for quite a while.
And you should guess who the actors would have been under the Stormtrooper hats, because often they are the people. Yeah,
Daniel
famous.
Craig was one.
I bet there's a bunch of weird cameos in this.
I'm sure there's going to be find revelations. Really?
I had a rumor that Prince Harry was in one of these.
I could totally see that. I think it's just like who was near Pinewood Studios.
Oh, actually,
everyone wants to visit a Star Wars set. You know?
Actually, there's something I have to give this film credit for. We were speculating about this off air. I'm glad to see that we weren't wrong about this. In the first film, they hinted at, with the John Boyega character, the first unmasked stormtrooper, that people were disenfranchised and taken away from their homes. Certainly casting a person of color in this role lends the credence to the idea that he is emphasizing that persons of a minority background are disenfranchised in this universe. They hint certainly in this film about disenfranchising more populations around the galaxy. The Last Jedi doesn't touch on this, but this film does. It develops on this and furthers this idea subtly and to some extent. And I appreciated this aspect of world building, which J.J. Abrams did bring back into this trilogy, which Rian Johnson, I'll take its criticism, neglected. He just didn't cover it in The Last Jedi.
By the way,
there's not much world building happening, so I'm glad that the little bit that happened actually kind of worked.
By the way, guys, we haven't read the reviews, but as we're rounding it out, they're coming in. It's very, very mixed. 58% on Rotten Tomatoes. This movie is going to, I think, disappoint at the box office.
It was just funny to watch it coming out of the cinema. Like, half people were saying, I really liked it. Half people were saying, nah, didn't like it. It wasn't vehemently either way, but just people kind of hovering. I think it's going to be extremely mixed.
I think with just the general...
More mixed than divisive.
I think with the general disappointment in Star Wars at the moment that... and the general feeling of burnout that people are going to be harsher on this than they might have otherwise been. I think people pass a lot of crappy blockbusters, but Knives will be out for this one. Knives out, by the way. Rian Johnson,
yeah.
Respect.
Yeah. But actually, look, and that's what...
to see episode 9.
And I think that's the point we're trying to make eventually, is the fact that I think at least being bold and going for a divisive movie at least gets a reaction out of you. At least you know where you stand. Where this movie is just kind of meh. Like, meh is not...
I don't take that point. I don't think trying to be divisive is an end goal of itself. Like,
no, it should
be. Engaging.
Why not? Like, at least...
I just read a blurb on Rotten Tomatoes as you were saying that was saying like that it feels like a shrug of the shoulders. Meh is kind of right, because like...
But is that what you should be going
it's
for?
It's the problem of conclusions, you know? When you're wrapping something up, it's so easy for everything to follow the foregone conclusions, and that's exactly what this film does. Are there any genuine surprises in this?
Endgame.
A memorable ending swerves. A memorable ending leaves you something to think about. As I said before, I don't think this really has any theme beyond just regurgitating general... themes that have been in the original trilogy.
10 years from now, people will still be watching The Last Jedi. People won't be watching The Force Awakens or this film nearly as much.
10 years from now, people are watching The Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. But honestly, the big problem with this series, I keep saying the big problem, like there's just one, but it's hard to stick the landing. I think the best third installment we've had was, Glenn will strongly disagree, but I think it was Revenge of the Sith, because it was, even though, yeah, that's how the series had to end, it at least felt fresh and different in how dark it went. I'm not saying that this had to have a really, really dark ending, but at least try to give us something we don't expect.
I wasn't a fan of Revenge of the Sith. They put the whole most interesting part of the prequel trilogy, i.e. Darth Vader's ascension and murdering of the younglings, into all of 20 minutes. So that frustrated me. I would be fascinated to do a Star Wars ranking of the 9 films on reflection. I think we're a little too tired. It's a little too early for that now, given we just saw this film, but we'll reflect on it more. We are excited to hear what you think, what audience think, what your actions are, as they'll soon pour in over the coming days.
We'll enter the new year with finally having some social media. So, you know, let's do that.
Ooh.
So tell us what you think.
Yeah, and our social tags will be ready. Because I was asked, actually, the person next to me asked me, what is the hashtag you guys use? And I was like, oh, well.
Yeah.
We'll see about that.
I think hashtag Film Fight Club is out there, but it's official now.
Yeah. FFC?
And now we are leading into what are the other most anticipated films of the year?
Cats.
Welcome back to Film Fight Club and our last of the year. This is Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen and Sydney filmmaker
Chris Evans.
Now you can hear our The Rise of Skywalker spoiler-free review and our Jumanji review on separate podcasts up now on iTunes, Spotify. It's been a big day. It's been a big day of Cats and Star Wars and Jumanji and films, and we're ready to talk about Cats. We're finally ready.
I guess so.
Are we ready to talk about Cats?
Well, let's see.
It's been one of the most anticipated, debated...
One of the most mocked films of the year, I would say.
Yes, the retroactive embargo, which is why we did not discuss it on our Wednesday night show, has been lifted as of 11 a.m. On Thursday.
We announced that we'd be covering Cats, but in the email inviting us, they forgot to mention that there was actually a worldwide embargo until 11 a.m. Thursday our time, so...
So here's our review.
Cats.
Which is again airing on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And it is the new Tom Hooper film.
Yes. Tom Hooper, I guess it kind of shows that some people just have the gift to fail upwards.
And Tom Hooper is certainly one of those people. We've seen him adapt a good musical, Les Mis, very badly, and now he's adapted a bad musical. We saw him in...
Very well.
No, I wish. Look, I went in I'm not a fan. I'm far from a fan of the musical. I do think it's the most overrated musical of all time, but I went in without expectations. I went in wanting to like it as I would any film, and yeah.
Me too. Okay, I realize now we usually open our reviews with a discussion of the plot, but this is unusually difficult for Cats.
Cats doesn't really have a plot. It's based on the poetry of T.S. Eliot, T.S. Eliot's book of practical cats, and follows Victoria, played by newcomer Francesca Haywood, the principal ballerina, for the London Royal Ballet, as she, a newly stray cat, encounters any number of other cats. Mr. Mistopheles, Rum Tum Tugger, McCavity, or all the jellicle cats played by... Among others, Idris Elba, Judi Dench, Ian McKellen, Ray Winston, James Corden, Rebel Wilson, Taylor Swift, Jason Derulo. There's quite an extensive cast here. And also in addition to Francesca Haywood, there are a few professional ballet dancers and dancers.
Yeah.
And it is directed by Tom Hooper. And importantly...
Written by Tom Hooper. First film of his career.
Yes. And unlike the stage musical, the Angela Rubber stage musical, which has makeup and costumes... While there may very well have been some of that deployed, the self-labeled digital fur technology is in use here, which looks, as Chris alluded to earlier in the year, like a bad deepfake for the better part of the film.
The faces are just kind of strangely floating on the bodies. Like, it just doesn't quite fit right. I think it's because human facial features just don't really gel that well with this vaguely cat-shaped head. It's a strange middle ground where they don't really have cat noses.
The hands are all inconsistent. Some have fingernails, some don't. The tails are all there.
I just found this film really uncanny to watch because I was over the weirdness and all the jokes and the memes about haha, the cats look bizarre from the trailer. But I felt it all over again watching this film because in the context of longer scenes that are actually meant to have some kind of dramatic flow to them, the way that they look is just as weird as it ever has been all over again. Because the uncanny effect I'm talking about is where something is just so absurd, but the film isn't aware of it. You know, it's like the feeling I was describing earlier this year when we spoke about the Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, except I think that was in on the joke and ironic, whereas this is just like you're witnessing such bad taste in the decisions on screen. And Tom Hooper was definitely very confident with his absurd vision here.
I think there's 3 points there. I think there's one actor who is recognizing the absolute absurdity of this, and this is Ian McKellen, who steals the show in a hilarious scene where he's just licking milk from a saucer.
He was just, it was so stupid. I think he knew how dumb it was.
There isn't, a large problem with this film is that there isn't any sustained dramatic tension. The story, and lack thereof, doesn't permit sustained dramatic tension because there is no dramatic arc. But more to the point of The Uncanny Valley, it's fascinating to compare this to The Lion King, the new animated version Disney released earlier this year. This is heavily criticized, bias included, for going to Uncanny Valley territory, where the bodies of the lions, in this case felines too, looked real, but their faces could in the moat. Tom Hooper has gone in the complete opposite direction.
Fully human faces
on cats' bodies. There is a middle ground. We've seen it pure animation, including Disney and the original Lion King, among many others, manage this to great effect over many decades. I'm okay with trying something new. I'm okay with them going in another direction. I appreciate the technology to be perfected has to be trialed. That's fine. The problem I have here is that this massively inconsistent approach. We heard that Tom Hooper was editing this up until the day of the release.
I mean, to be that happens with
that happens,
a lot
in fairness,
of
that's true. But there is such an inconsistent approach to how the faces are rendered. It's very distinct with the actress we didn't mention, American Idol. I'm sorry.
Jennifer Hudson,
who did Memory.
Her face in the original trailer looked the worst out of all of them, I think.
They have improved it. So, as Tom Hooper has said, and I quote, they've come a long way since the original trailer, in fairness.
No, it still has
in respects.
I think it still has the same uncanny effect. It's just that certain faces have just been fixed. Maybe they've responded to the criticism, but the concept for the designs, the way that it's basically a human body except it's got a tail, they've got cat ears and fur and human faces, and sometimes they prowl around on four legs and sometimes they walk around on two legs. It's just, as soon as the film started, I was just thinking, what the hell am I watching? Just like seeing all these, that Cats overture that we opened the segment with, while these strange hybrid cat-human things crawl around. It's actually really creepy.
It's really disturbing.
It's really disturbing. And yeah, the movie just never left that point of weirdness for me. Like every now and again, I had this kind of like disassociation from the narrative feeling where, as like I said, the experience of watching these strange cat people emote and carry this sort of story is just so weird that I would keep getting taken out of the scenes and think, like, what were they thinking? How did this get okayed? And
I don't know.
It looks really expensive, but even putting aside the horror of these designs, it looks really fake.
It looks fake. It looks bad.
Plastic. It looks, there's... The CG just kind of isn't perfect. There's a kind of lack of fluidity. Like, it's hard to put it down. Do you know the way that bad CG, just the motion of it, just like looks kind of weird? But the flow, the level of weight. This is all motion captured. Obviously, these are pretty much the movements.
It's much more than that.
But
it comes down here.
It looks plasticine. They don't really look like they're integrated into their environment. And they move weirdly. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it gives a fake impression.
I think what it is, and what really lends to it, is the lack of quality in the direction and choreography. Now, you look at Francesca Haywood, who's a professional ballerina and is very good, actually my favorite performer in this, where she and a few of the other professionals, and in fairness, some of the professional actors, are moving like in the stage show as cats do, whereas some of the other performers are moving like humans, just flailing about.
Yeah.
And it is more, it makes it more of a distracting when you're supposed to be believing that you are only watching cat people. On the matter of the choreography and direction, Chris referred earlier to the overture. For all its faults, and I'm not a fan of a musical that is repetitive and droning and doesn't really have a plot and has a number of annoying numbers. There's a few redeeming ones. I don't mind Elements of Memory. Rum Tum Tug
is
kind of catchy. The overture is interesting, but the overture
is
my favorite musical piece in the whole musical because it has that great clash of cymbals, which we played as we introduced to the show. I was waiting for this a couple of times in the musical. At the very beginning, there's a scene where they play the overture as we're introduced to Victoria, the Francesca Haywood character. But as in Les Mis, there's a disconnect between the levels that the music is going, or the symphony, what would be the symphony in the pit, and the dialogue. Most stage productions get this pretty on pat, on a pod. However, they're not working at the correct levels here. So you can't often hear the music, which is one of the more redeeming aspects of this production, because some of the dialogue or some of the sound effects too loud. And there's an inconsistent approach to this too. Sometimes it's the music, which is swelling too greatly, but not at the moments where the music is supposed to swell or where you want to necessarily draw attention to the music. A lot of Cats is very subtle and subdued, but these are the moments where Tom Hooper conversely dials it up. And it's weird. It's strange. Like, Les Mis was not a good adaptation, and you see the very highly divisive rendering of I Dreamed a Dream. I'm not a fan of it because it was very muted. It's not a muted song, and you can see that same sort of approach to memory here, which is the ballad of this. So I don't think Tom Hooper is someone who's necessarily well equipped to deal with musicals, and now he's been given arguably the most successful, famous musical or musical of all time.
Yeah. It's a musical that I think probably should have stayed on stage or just been made as an animated film.
I would have, I'm not a fan of the musical, but I would have watched an animated film of Cats.
In the 90s, Steven Spielberg was going to produce a version with the team from Balto making it, and the cats looked like actual cats.
Balto, yeah.
I think that would have been great.
I think that would have, like,
you can see concept art. The idea was that it's actual cats. But this, as Glenn has said, there's really no plot. I found that it is kind of boring at a certain point because it's just veering from, you know, song to song with the smallest of plot threads running through it. But there were times that I was interested in it just because the whole thing's so goddamn weird.
Yeah.
Like, for all the faults, and there are many, Tom Hooper's definitely trying to entertain you here and go all out with a musical spectacular that's like nothing anyone's ever seen. And there are moments where, like you said, with Ian McKellen licking his paws and saying, yum, 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 things like that.
Growling. Just Ian McKellen growling stole the whole show.
Exactly. Or there's a great number with Rebel Wilson running around doing comedy, and so I'm calling it a great number.
I
somewhat
that.
Ironically,
she was not especially good. And also, that was the sequence where they introduced the non-cat.
Well, that's what I was getting to. That's the reason why I call this actually a quote-unquote great number, because it just assaulted me with horrors that I was.
Yeah, there were non-cat animated humans. It was like, very weird. It was probably the most disconcerting element of it.
The thing about this film is that there's definitely going to be ironic enjoyment in it because it's just so weird.
But there's some, and it's just, that's ironic enjoyment.
Not enough for 2 hours.
But not enough for 2 hours.
That's why it gets boring.
You referred earlier to the stage aspect of it, how there's all these different segments. This Cats, more generally, could have worked like a variety or vaudeville show, but I think it has much bigger aspirations and is even self-aggrandizing. And I would have been fine with a Muppet-esque, you know, cats running about the stage here and there. But that's not what this is. I agree. On the horror of that particular sequence.
Didn't you just find it kind of funny? Like, what?
But the animals were just so poorly rendered. That was the most distracting part.
They looked really bad.
So I could have enjoyed it if there had been a little more effort put into it, or if they had been able to manage it more.
I think just aesthetically, the film kind of just looks bad. All these dark blues and yellows, but
which they take from the stage musical, in fairness. But it works. That sort of lighting can work better in a stage environment.
This has a bit of a more intense kind of neonish glow than the stage production, though. Like, the stage production is much darker, I think.
Yeah.
This kind of really looks like it, kind of like Avatar.
Oh, God. On the matter
unfair?
Of... A little bit. Not unfair. I'm not a fan of Avatar. Avatar is better than this.
Oh, well, of course.
On the matter of the stage production, Angela Weber wasn't the first person to do this, but one of the reasons it is so popular is that he more generally popularized the idea of an immersive stage experience, because the Cats, you know, the whole stage is used more than our traditional productions, and still Cats leave about the stage, come through the aisles. If anyone's been to the Lion King musical, it draws a lot from that sort of tradition. So there is an appeal to watching Cats on stage. That can't be here because we're just watching a screen. But there is an appeal, nonetheless, to seeing cats and people jump and leave about the stage. But the problem is, we can't see it. And because it's the same direction He used it in The King's Speech, and he used in Les Mis. There's not a lot. Either there's too much headspace between characters, or there's not enough headspace. Additionally, there are very quick cuts. I watched the first 10 minutes of, well, first half of Six Underground a little while ago. This sort of editing style works with Michael Bay films, where it's very action-orientated. But in these sorts of circumstances, I'm a fan of ballet. I'm a fan of dance. I would just like to sit back and watch some dances. And there are very few opportunities we actually get to do so.
I agree, but compared to, for example, musicals directed by Rob Marshall, and definitely compared to Les Mis, I thought this film actually gave a fair bit of headroom and space to watch the people dance. Like, it could have been much worse. Les Mis, half of it was shot, like, a few centimeters from someone's nose, whereas this, you know, at times did pull back to give us wider views of the dance. But I agree, it's not a Bugsy Berkeley musical.
No, there were bits where like heads and or feet were cut off. There are bits where characters are shepherded in the corner of the frame. The only sequence to this effect I really liked was the Jellicoe Ball. Now, this isn't the entirety of the Jellicoe Ball, but there were maybe 10 shots, 12 shots that lasted longer than 5 or 7 seconds, which were a little bit drawn back and were cleaner, or I could just watch Hayward and the other dancers dance. And you know what? I like ballet. I grew up watching ballet. It was the first performance I ever went to, and I thoroughly enjoyed this moment. And it's with Cats Productions, I've seen, I'll be fair, not the musical stagings, but I've seen videoed National Theatre Live type productions. I've enjoyed those moments, and certainly that's what fans of the musical will come to see here. But they won't get that because there's too many fast cuts, too choppy, changey. It's like we have to have a camera here and a camera here and a camera here. It was Hooper style in other films, but it's even more pronounced here. It's distracting, and sometimes it's just imperceptible. And that bothered me. I wish it just made it a bit a cleaner film.
I think it's a lost art. And I agree. Tom Hooper, in general, has shown pretty poor choices all throughout his career in where he places the camera. There's not much momentum to this narratively, obviously, but there also isn't just the momentum of it as a showpiece. Good camera placement and good choreography around the camera and vice versa has its own kind of entertainment value and momentum. And I think the only thing that gives this film any kind of pull is the weirdness and the what are they going to think of next aspect to it, and the fact that it's so full-on intense in trying to please the audience. But that grows pretty boring quickly.
The one thing that does and can redeem this film are the performers. I referred to some of the ones I didn't like earlier. I don't think James Corden is really especially good in this or in some of his other musical productions. I liked Elba and McKellen just for being overly charming. Judi Dench and all the others, they were serviceable. They were fine.
I think the actors actually give good performances. I think Judi Dench was good. I thought even Taylor Swift was good.
Even Taylor Swift, yeah. In fairness, yeah. She is, yeah. Look, this is her first film in 5.5 years. She's not a great actress. She wasn't good at Valentine's Day, yeah. The Giver. Her and Francesca Hayward are actually my two favorite performers in here, and I'll say why. They were operating at a much more theatrical, over-the-top register. If anyone saw The King earlier in the year, Joel Edgerton is operating a similar register where everyone else is very muted. However, conversely, it works here because it's such, as Chris has alluded, such an over-the-top, bombastic affair. Taylor did it like she was doing any of her last four tours, all the way back to Speak Now. If you watch
here video comes clips, the Taylor like, fan.
I am a big Taylor fan. I was excited to see her in this. And I think my favorite Taylor video clip is Blank Space. And it's that sort of thing. It's hyper-exaggerated, over-the-top. She's doing the same sort of thing here. She did it in You Belong With Me, did it in Out of the Woods. And she's good here. She's treating it like one of the stage shows I've been to. Francesca Hayward, too. She's not a traditional film actress, but she's, again, hyper-exaggerated, using big expressions, which in a lot of films, we talked, I think, offline about the producers' 2005 adaptation last week and how it didn't work.
When
it was terrible because Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick looked like they were trying to reach the back halls.
It was directed by the person who directed the Broadway production, and she tried to carry over just everything exactly as it worked on Broadway by the looks of it.
But
it did not work.
It didn't, but that's because it's more traditional settings. But Cats, it does work, and Hayward knew that. I think McKellen knew that too. And all the others are operating at a more regular film, and it just doesn't work.
It's hard to even... I've been struggling for things to say about this film because I do not really know how to begin analyzing it. It's so weird. As I've said before, it is going to have a life just for people who, I guess, want to get high and watch some total nonsense.
Yeah, there's an audience.
Definitely.
Even then, there are better films you could watch.
Cats, though, like...
Honestly, it's a 110-minute film.
It's way too long.
There's about 8 watchable minutes. And the thing is, the sad thing is... this is the point we're supposed to say, who is this film for? It's for people who don't like the musical. It's not for you. Steer clear. For people who do like the musical, it actually detracts a lot from what does make the musical good. Mm. So even if you're a hardcore fan, you may enjoy it. But if you're a casual fan of Cats, I think you're actually going to be disappointed in major respects.
I don't think a general audience is going to respond to this, because I think the way that it's just weirdness with no story, I don't think that has much appeal to people outside of theater nerds and the subset of theater nerds who actually like Cats.
That's a small...
That's right.
Small proportion.
It's a running joke these days, more than something that people actually enjoy, I think.
I was fascinated by this. Even if I wasn't a Taylor fan, I would go and see it because it's been talked about so much. And look, it doesn't live up to the hype in near any respect.
I think the hype was just entirely people who wanted to hate watch it and talk about how horrific it is. So I think it definitely lives up to the hype.
Which might be more enjoyable if it was like 80 minutes instead of 110. So that is Cats. It is in cinemas come Boxing Day. And that is our... So check out our podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And we'll be back in the new year with our Star Wars Rise of Skywalker spoilers discussion.
We'll be talking about Little Women. We'll talk about Sorry We Missed You. Maybe more words on Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
And our best of 2019, and the decade, which we're saving for, you know, the end, actually, once 2019 is concluded.
That's right. We are always lazy procrastinators. And so it continues.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy whatever you celebrate, honestly. Happy life.
Happy holidays. Enjoy
life. Happy holidays, yeah.
Enjoy. Have the most wonderful New Year. Just
all the best from us.